This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Governor Dan Malloy had this to say following yesterday's announcement on the formation of a state council on climate change.
You know, I think that the New England states, as part of REGI, are acutely aware and have acted on the desire to combat climate change. But we're also in this very tough situation of having the highest energy costs in America, in part because of an underinvestment and, I think, an unwillingness to have properly courted the marketplace with respect to natural gas.
Now, Malloy's reference to REGI is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, one of many ways the New England states are working together on climate change issues. But now energy needs for the region are taking center stage as calls for increased natural gas infrastructure come into conflict with local governments who have worries about pipelines and environmentalists who are pushing for more investment in renewables. That's why five of six New England governors will meet in Hartford today for a closed-door energy roundtable. They'll spend some time with reporters, and our own Patrick Scahill will be covering the meeting for us. Together, these governors will be working on developing a cooperative strategy to addressing some of the region's biggest energy challenges. Today, we'll check in with reporters from Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Rhode Island to find out what the strategy between these governors and these states might look like. A bit later on, we'll also get an update on the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and find out how this new fast-track trade bill could impact business here in Connecticut. If you have thoughts on natural gas expansion or energy prices and needs here in Connecticut, join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us first, the political reporter for WBUR in Boston, Asma Khalid. And Asma, thanks so much for joining us once again. I appreciate it.
No problem. Happy to be here.
So you've been following your governor, Charlie Baker, who's brand new as the governor of Massachusetts. You sat down with him to reflect on his first 100 days in office. How much was he talking about energy issues with you?
Well, to be honest, energy never came up. I just met with him last Friday to talk about his first 100 days in office. And to be fair, most of Governor Baker's tenure so far has been consumed first with snow and then our troubled transit system. So he has had a sort of full plate with those two agendas. And I think energy has taken a back seat, at least on his public agenda. But it was an issue that he addressed during his inauguration speech in January when he spoke about the direct link between economic growth and affordable energy supply. And let's take a listen to what he had to say.
As we begin this new year, families and businesses across New England are being hit with unprecedented increases in their energy and electric bill. At exactly the same time, energy prices are falling across the rest of the country. This increase is being driven in large part by inadequate delivery systems, the result of poor planning and coordination. I look forward to working with my colleagues here in Massachusetts in the legislature and with people like Governor Raimondo of Rhode Island and the other New England governors to solve this problem while we continue to reduce our carbon footprint.
John, you heard the governor there speaking briefly about it. He mentioned energy issues again after a visit to Washington where he met with some of these other New England governors, but it hasn't really been high on the agenda so far.
You know, obviously one of the things that we've talked about in the past around Massachusetts specifically and energy has been the Cape Wind Project, some of the NIMBY issues that come into figuring out a way to get renewables into the Bay State. If you could characterize what Governor Baker might be thinking about around energy infrastructure, is it really encapsulated in that little bit from his speech where, you know, much like Governor Malloy and the others, he's working on this infrastructure project that seemingly is the reason why we're having this meeting today?
You know, that may be fair. I know he's certainly spoken about the need to have a regional partnership, specifically pointing out Connecticut and Rhode Island, when he wants to delve into infrastructure around clean energy resources, which he said will lead, he thinks, to lower prices. And the other thing, I think, in addition to clean energy resources, where he feels the regional partnership would be valuable, is in trying to expand natural gas capacity. That's been something that we've heard time and again here in Massachusetts, particularly around the idea of a pipeline coming through the state or multiple pipelines coming through the state, and how that may help lower energy costs, particularly in the winter.
And he supports the pipeline expansion project. Of course, this is something that comes up in all of the little towns across New England. It's one of the reasons we wanted to have this conversation, because much like Connecticut, many of the communities in the other New England states have these little town-by-town governments. And in some places, I know, Asma, the local folks are taking a look at pipeline expansion and saying, well, that may help the problem of needs for natural gas in our overall energy infrastructure, but if the pipeline comes through my town, maybe not so much. Are you hearing some of these concerns from people in Massachusetts?
Very much so. In fact, I was speaking yesterday with our energy reporter, who's done a lot of work, particularly on the pipeline, visiting some of these smaller communities, as you mentioned, and this is an issue that comes up time and again. I think many of our local communities here in Massachusetts are opposed to the pipeline. Even within the members of our congressional delegation, I think there's a lot of sort of a mixed reaction to what's the appropriate cause and what's the appropriate solution to high energy costs. So it's interesting to hear the governor focus, I think, a lot on high prices because of natural gas capacity, because we've certainly had all the members of our congressional delegation speak to that issue, but also kind of point more to fears about market manipulation. One of our congressmen, Joe Kennedy III, he had a meeting, I want to say it was just last month, where he organized a number of other members of the delegation looking at whether or not the high prices were actually just unfair because of a market that rewards generators for being available at peak demand times. So it's interesting that, you know, everyone seems to recognize that we are having high energy costs, particularly in the winter, but what that solution is, I think, differs between the governor and members of our congressional delegation.
One last thing for you, Asma. It seems as though the new governor at least is talking about working across party lines and across state lines to solve some of these issues. In your talks with him about the first 100 days, even though he didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about energy per se, do you have a sense that this is a guy who sees Massachusetts as really key to tying together all the New England states in whatever way possible, whether it has to do with energy or transportation? I mean, it's a real key part of New England. Does it seem like he's going to work with the other governors here?
Yes, sure, Dan. I mean, I think that's probably very true. You probably heard in that clip he singled out Governor Gina Raimondo from Rhode Island in particular, and that's because she was actually there at Governor Baker's inauguration. And he's certainly, I think, taken a very bipartisan approach here in the state. We just had a poll that came out yesterday referencing that his favorable ratings are, I think, 74% throughout the state. So he's certainly well-liked, and we are a very deep blue state, so plenty of registered Democrats. And I think that because of that bipartisan approach where he's reached out on, you know, transportation and energy issues and tried to create a bipartisan cabinet, he's taken an approach of trying to coordinate with the people he thinks are competent to get the job done. And I would assume that that's the same approach you would try to take with neighboring states.
Asma Khalid is the political reporter for WBUR in Boston. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
No problem. You're welcome.
And we're talking about the energy summit that is happening amongst five of the New England governors in Hartford, Connecticut today. Governor Malloy is convening these governors to talk about energy and infrastructure. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Turning a bit north from Massachusetts to Maine, Mal Leary is political correspondent for the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Mal, thanks for joining us.
Morning.
Well, you've been talking with your governor, Paul LePage, about some of his goals for this meeting. As a matter of fact, honestly, I have to say, Mal, there wasn't a whole lot of talk about this meeting until you told us that it was going to happen this week, even though it was in our backyard. So it seems like Governor LePage is all set to talk about energy with these other governors.
Yeah, he certainly is. Energy is a very important issue for him. He keeps citing two major issues for this session. One is his tax reform package, which is a sweeping tax reform package and a story all to itself. And his second issue is energy. And he told me yesterday when he was leaving to go down to Connecticut for the meeting that he has two goals meeting with the other governors. One is to convince them to work together to bring in additional pipeline capacity for natural gas into New England. And secondly, for them to work together to buy more power from Canada, pointing out that right now Hydro-Quebec generates a lot of power that is relatively cheap, and that if transmission lines were constructed to bring that down and an agreement could be reached with the Canadians, that too could help solve the energy problems for New England.
Of course, there's a lot in that right there. Even that question about whether the hydropower that's coming down from Quebec is something that could be considered renewable. Is that something that has caused any conversation in your state, Mal, where maybe environmentalists are looking at that and saying, well, hold on, that's maybe not the way we want to invest in renewable power, bringing it all the way down from Canada with these very big hydro plans?
Well, obviously, hydropower is renewable. It's sort of the definition of renewable. But what the environmentalists are talking about are other sources, which we have a lot in Maine. We have wood-fired plants. We have wind power farms, they call them, because they're so big with so many turbines that are generating electricity. And because we're Maine and we have so much wood, there is a lot of use of wood, not only for generating electricity, but for home heating. So there is a lot of diversity for renewables in our state, but the bottom line the governor keeps stressing is we've got to have this consistent lower-cost power that you can get from natural gas, or you could get, or in conjunction with, bringing down power from Canada, which costs a lot less than the cost of actually generating power ourselves using any number of fossil fuels.
Are the people of Maine behind plans to bring in more natural gas infrastructure? As I was talking with Asma Khalid, of course, when it gets down to actually putting the pipeline in the ground, people do get a little bit worried about pipes coming through their backyard. What are you hearing from residents there?
Well, the not in my backyard syndrome is there for you for anything. I mean, any major construction effort, folks don't like the windmills that are generating power in their backyard. They don't like the pipelines going through. But in most, here in Maine, we have had very little access to natural gas. We've had to rely on home heating oil, which is far more expensive than natural gas, for a lot of residential heating. So the move in the last few years, as the pipeline coming down from Canada and additional capacity coming up from southern New England has gone into play, people are beginning to realize, hey, this is a lot better way to heat my home is with natural gas. And we're seeing, you know, thousands of homes, individuals shifting their homes over to natural gas as the gas companies are building the lateral pipelines out from the big pipeline. So we're way behind Connecticut and Massachusetts and the southern New England states in terms of access to natural gas for the simplest of things like heating our homes, let alone generating electricity.
Before I let you go, Mal, I should ask you a bit about how Governor LePage maybe differs from some of the other Northeast governors here. And I think it's fair to say that Governor LePage has different ideas than other governors on a lot of different things. But he really maybe views the whole idea of electric regulation or deregulation differently. I mean, how would he restructure the entire electric business in Maine if he had his way?
Well, I did a story earlier this week with the governor that surprised a lot of people, where he's put in a governor's bill that would undo the electric restructuring in Maine that occurred back in 2000. We split back then in 2000 the distribution and transmission part of an electric company from the generating of electricity.
Yep.
The idea was the generation would then be more competitive and that we reduce costs. Governor LePage doesn't think it's worked out that way, so he's saying he wants to have the ability, with the approval of the state's Public Utilities Commission, the existing distribution companies be able to go and buy assets or build new generating facilities, and in essence go back into somewhat the business of generating electricity as well as distributing it. That kind of turns the philosophy of the last 15 years on the head and has caused a lot of folks in the legislature to go, what is he talking about? Because they argue that the Maine electric prices have kept lower than other parts of New England. For example, we are right now the lowest average price for electricity in New England. So they're saying, you know, this competition's been working. Why do you want to screw with this? Well, the governor thinks it's the better way to go, so he's put that legislation in. He definitely follows a different drummer from most governors. He has told me on numerous occasions, I'm not a politician, and you got to get used to that. I'm a businessman.
Yeah, he may be a businessman, but he seems like a politician who's running the state of Maine. Governor Paul LePage is one of five governors from around New England in Connecticut today at the Connecticut Convention Center. They're meeting on energy issues, and we're covering it here at WNPR with a group of reporters who are covering it from afar. Mal Leary is the political correspondent for Maine Public Broadcasting Network. I'll let you get back to watching some of these hearings online, Mal, and we'll be reporting for you later on, all right?
Okay, John.
Hey, when we come back from our break, we're going to continue our roundtable going around New England talking about energy issues. We're going to check in with Rhode Island Public Radio and Vermont Public Radio. You can join us at 860-275-7266. This is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. New England governors are meeting in Hartford today to talk about energy and energy infrastructure. The Republicans and Democrats are all getting together around the table at the request of Governor Dan Malloy. We'll have more coverage later on this afternoon on All Things Considered with our own Patrick Scahill. But for now, we're taking a look around the region with some of the reporters who are covering these governors in their home states. We'll turn next to Rhode Island and Rhode Island Public Radio's Ian Donis to find out exactly what we expect the Rhode Island Governor, Governor Raimondo, to bring to the table. Ian Donis, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Again, Sean.
So first of all, what have been some of your governor's responses to the region's big energy challenges? We heard Charlie Baker say specifically wanting to work with Rhode Island on energy projects. So what's Governor Raimondo saying?
Well, this is an important issue. It tends to register with consumers and most people only in winter when utility prices spike and then the weather warms up and most people don't think about it. But the fact of the matter is that Rhode Island has among the highest electricity prices in the nation. So that's a big issue, not just for consumers and residents, but also for business, particularly when you consider that Rhode Island has been struggling with one of the nation's highest unemployment rates ever since the recession. Things have gotten a little bit better recently, but the cost of energy remains a big concern for public officials like Governor Raimondo. We haven't heard much of a sweeping proposal from the governor on what she hopes to do with that. And I think for a small state like Rhode Island, it makes a lot of sense to try to collaborate with Massachusetts and some of the other New England states. I think that motivates Governor Raimondo to take part in the discussion like the one taking place today. Her response has been so far in a little bit of a different direction with Rhode Island's state treasurer, Seth Magaziner. They have proposed the expansion of a state agency that handles drinking water, groundwater, and road and bridge improvements to also do some retrofitting of public buildings to make them more energy efficient. They see this as something that would not only have positive environmental effects, but it would save money. Municipalities in Rhode Island spend about $50 million a year each year on electricity. That's a lot of money in a small state like Rhode Island. And this program, if it is funded by the legislature before the General Assembly lets out probably in June, would also have the added bonus of putting construction workers back to work. The construction trades have been very hard hit in Rhode Island by the recession. So that's been the focus of Governor Raimondo so far, to try and back this program, kind of a green infrastructure bank in shorthand, to help pay for some retrofitting of public buildings to make them more energy efficient.
And it's a project similar to some that we've heard about here in Connecticut. What's interesting, I think, that you're talking about, Ian, is that it seems like your governor is approaching this from the efficiency side, at least as much as the capacity side. A lot of what we've been talking about so far is the need by some governors to say, look, we got to build more capacity because we have all of this desire for natural gas-fired power plants. More people are using it for home heating in the region. We need to get those pipelines so we can increase the capacity. Sounds like your governor is taking a look at this in a way that contains at least as much efficiency as it does capacity.
Yeah, I think the pipeline issue is a serious one as well. I mean, anecdotally, I know of a number of people in Rhode Island who have switched from oil to natural gas in recent years because it's much cheaper to buy, and there are issues with the pipeline in Rhode Island as elsewhere. And, you know, there are some in the environmental community who think that a greater pipeline capacity is not the answer. You have different opinions on that. But, yes, we are seeing a focus by Governor Raimondo on trying to boost the efficiency of buildings. That was something she talked a lot about in her campaign. Once again, she described that as something with multiple effects by putting people back to work, saving energy costs, and making buildings more energy efficient as well.
And that's the other piece of this, too, putting people back to work. Obviously, if you're trying to increase any sort of capacity or you're trying to build new infrastructure, it does have the side result of putting people back to work. And as you've already suggested, Ian, that's really a big problem in Rhode Island. The other states hit hard by the recession, of course, but Rhode Island seems to be lagging coming out of it in a way. Does she see this as an opportunity to really have a business plan, put more people back to work as she's trying to increase efficiency?
Absolutely. Jobs in the economy are issue number one for Governor Raimondo. The construction trades are still really hurting for work in Rhode Island. Rhode Island now has the 10th worst unemployment rate in the nation for much of the recent history. It was about the second or third worst unemployment. So things have gotten a little bit better. But there are a lot of out-of-work construction workers who would jump at the opportunity to do some of this kind of work.
We're talking with Ian Donis, who covers politics for Rhode Island Public Radio. We're talking about a meeting that's happening in Hartford today. It's five New England governors, not the governor of New Hampshire was not able to attend, but five New England governors getting together to talk about energy and infrastructure. And we're going around the region to try to find out what the real needs are. Before I let you go, Ian, obviously, Rhode Island, it's the ocean state. You've got a lot of water there. How are you folks thinking about wind power, hydropower? Is that on the table right now in Rhode Island?
Yes, it is. There's a demonstration wind farm that is moving ahead off the coast of Block Island. It was very controversial a few years ago when Rhode Island's Public Utilities Commission okayed a plan for that to go forward because the per kilowatt cost was quite a bit higher than the market rate. Proponents said it's worth it to go ahead with developing that kind of wind power because other forms of energy are expected to get more expensive in the future, and it's good to have the capacity for wind power. So that is continuing to move forward.
Ian Donis covers politics for Rhode Island Public Radio. Ian, as always, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to turn now to Vermont, John Dillon's news director at Vermont Public Radio. And John, welcome back to our program. Thanks so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Good morning, Karen.
In his 2015 inaugural speech, your governor, Peter Shumlin, promised Vermont was on its way to becoming an energy innovation leader in the United States. What was he talking about there, and how is he moving forward with this pledge?
Well, a key part of Governor Shumlin's tenure has been his promotion of renewable energy. He wants the state of Vermont to be a leader in that. He's done a lot to promote solar and wind power. We have a net metering program where people can get paid, get their electricity bills reduced for sending electricity back to the grid from renewable sources. And I think where it plays out in the region is that Vermont could be, and our governor, I think, envisions the state as this, as an exporter of renewable electricity for southern New England. As you know, the southern New England states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, issued an RFP some time ago for a lot of new renewable energy. Vermont could be a supplier, and we could also be a transmission route from other places, potentially upstate New York, potentially Hydro-Quebec, for renewable power down to southern New England. So I think Governor Shumlin sees Vermont as being both a pathway for renewables and a source for renewables for southern New England.
Of course, one of the issues for many environmentalists is that the need for renewables in the region sometimes put on the back burner because there is seen this window of low-cost natural gas, the possibility of using this as a bridge fuel. Obviously, a lot of New England has been heating homes with oil for years, and now a lot of it's turning to natural gas. Many of the old dirty power plants have turned to natural gas power plants. I don't know, John, does it seem in Vermont as though maybe these conversations about natural gas, a fossil fuel, maybe a cleaner one, but a fossil fuel nonetheless, are overshadowing some of the governor's wishes for more renewables for the region?
Well, it's interesting. We have a local gas pipeline project that's been delayed and hung up a bit, you would say, on cost estimates. So this would go down the western side of the state to Middlebury, Vermont, and eventually potentially down to Rutland. And that project came in at one price, $80 million. Now it's around $120 million. So the regulators are taking a second look at it. There are environmental opponents who say you are just swapping out one fossil fuel for another. And, of course, the other side of that is that it's a much cleaner fossil fuel. It's not really renewables versus gas debate here, and this pipeline wouldn't do anything to alleviate the transmission, gas transmission bottleneck in southern New England, which those pipelines come from a different direction. This one's coming down north from Canada. So it's more of a local debate, and it's very much of a backyard debate, too, where people don't want a pipeline running, through their neighborhoods. But the governor, Shumlin, again, sees natural gas as a boost to the economy because it's a cheaper fuel right now than fuel oil.
How do residents of Vermont feel about being that transmission line for that cheap power coming from Quebec that we were talking about earlier in the program?
Well, I think there's a bit of a self-interest argument. Vermont would be the route. We don't really need it. Unlike other New England states, we are not deregulated. So the utilities here over the last 30 years have had long-term contracts with Hydro-Québec, and we get about a third of our electricity under long-term contracts from Hydro-Québec. So we get that benefit now. So if we are the transmission route, I think the regulators here and the public here would argue for some benefit off the top, maybe a tariff that our transmission utility would collect for being the route of that electricity down south. There's about seven of these transmission projects proposed from the north to the south, a couple of them through Vermont, one in New Hampshire that I'm sure you've heard about, the Northern Pass, which is a big, big power line that's been held up by local opposition. All of these designed to bring electricity from big dams up in Quebec down to Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut to satisfy both the need for renewable baseload power and also for these for your state's renewable energy portfolios, which is a requirement that a certain percentage of your electricity come from renewable sources. So the southern New England states are basically looking north, and they're looking north through Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine to get that electricity.
A last thing for you, John. Can we learn anything from the Vermont experience of not deregulating your energy market in the way that we did? I mean, we talked earlier with Mallory from Maine, and maybe the governor there is thinking about going back to the good old days, he thinks. Have prices stayed low in Vermont under the old system of regulated energy?
It's a really interesting development historically, because in the 90s you had this real push across industries to deregulate everything from trucking to airlines to electricity. Vermont didn't do it for a number of reasons. And yes, we have had more stable rates. Our utilities haven't played the market. They entered into these long-term contracts because they could get, under rate of return regulation, they could get basically their investments recovered in rates over long periods of time. So there is more incentive under that regulatory structure to do long-term contracts and long-term planning and not be subject to the vagaries of the market as much. Now you're hearing, well, maybe, electric generation, electric delivery is a natural monopoly. maybe it was better regulated, strictly regulated, you know, with distribution utilities being given a franchise to sell as a monopoly in exchange for strict regulation. That's the situation that we kept here. And, you know, as you're hearing in Maine, maybe it was a better course because we don't have these huge spikes. We don't have the winter spikes that Ian was talking about in Rhode Island. Our rates are levelized over the year and aren't subject to what the spot market for power is doing.
Once again, we look north, the laboratory of New England, Vermont. John Dillon, thanks so much for joining us once again from Vermont Public Radio.
My pleasure, John.
And we'll continue our coverage throughout the day of this meeting that's happening at the Connecticut Convention Center. Governor Malloy pulling together five New England governors to talk about energy and infrastructure. When we come back, we're going to talk about a controversial trade plan, what it might mean here in Connecticut. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Pope Francis recently called the 1915 deaths of more than a million Armenians a genocide. The Turkish government has not responded kindly. To mark the 100th anniversary of this grim event, we'll speak with local experts and artists about what happened and some of the lasting political tensions that still exist today. And did you know that one of two plaster casts of Pope John Paul II's hands are in Chicopee, Massachusetts, of all places? It's part of a collection of thousands of pieces of Polish culture and history. Our own Katie Talarski gets a tour of the Polish Center of Discovery and Learning. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. Today we're checking in on what could become the largest trade deal in history. In a vote yesterday, the Senate Finance Committee approved a fast-track bill that would give the Obama administration new powers to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership through Congress. Here to tell us more about this bill and its impact on the agreement is David Nakamura, who covers the White House for The Washington Post. David, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us to talk about some of the local implications of this legislation is John Bartow. He's former VP and general manager of Ansonia Copper and Brass. Welcome to our program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here.
David, first of all, why don't you explain exactly what is happening in Congress right now around this fast-track provision and where we see it?
Right. So the president has asked Congress to go forward with a bill that would allow him to a little bit of an easier path to bring a big trade bill forward. So Congress is not actually looking at the actual trade bill, which is still being negotiated between the U.S. and 11 other countries in the Asia Pacific. So right now what Congress is looking at is a bill called Fast Track Authority that would allow the president to bring ultimately this trade deal up for an up or down vote and would not allow members of Congress to amend the trade terms after they're presented by the president. And, you know, the White House wants this so that the trade deal is not picked to death by 535, you know, lawmakers with different interests. You know, trading partners frown on that, and they're not going to come to the table with their best final offer, as the U.S. negotiators say, unless they have this power. Those who are opposed to it, including labor unions and environmental groups, say it's basically a rubber stamp. We don't know the final terms of the deal, yet Congress is saying, yes, we'll allow the president to bring it forward without any potential amendment. So right now, the Senate committee, led by Republicans, passed this yesterday with some Democratic support. It will go to the full Senate likely next month. It is expected probably to make it through. The question is in the House, where the margins are more difficult, and right now the president's in a pretty much a full force lobbying campaign. He'll talk about it to supporters of his former campaign organization, OFA, later today at one of their meetings here in D.C.
So those are some of the politics around this fast-track provision. We don't know the terms of the deal. So what do we know, David? And what can you tell us about what this trade pact would do?
It's a massive trade deal involving 12 nations that together compose about 40% of the world's gross domestic product, mostly in the Asia-Pacific on both sides, in Asia, also Canada and Mexico and some South American countries are involved. The U.S. really got involved heavily in this a few years back as President Obama elevated as part of his Asia strategy. And what it is a big trade and regulatory deal. It's a framework that the U.S. says will help U.S. interests in Asia. It's a fast-growing area. The United States is concerned about China's growing economic influence in that region, and this is an idea that the U.S. is going to get more involved in the fabric, not just of trade and sort of old-fashioned ideas of tariff reductions with Japan and other countries that are involved, but also on newer ideas about intellectual property that, you know, folks in Hollywood and Silicon Valley are concerned about. Also, big multinational U.S. corporations are concerned that some of the Asian markets limit their ability to sort of play fairly against Asia-controlled state markets. And so there will be new structures to solve disputes there, too. Again, some of the sort of more liberal groups have very big concerns that this opens the way for big multinational corporations to have some advantages but will harm U.S. workers. So the old trade, you know, sort of fault lines are starting to show themselves. And it's interesting politics because the president, of course, has to bring his own party along.
He has to bring his own party along. He responded to some of this pushback on MSNBC's Hardball recently.
Some of the information that's been getting thrown out there plays into legitimate fears that Democratic voters have and progressives have. But it's simply not true. It's simply not the facts.
He's making a case that essentially people don't have the entire story. Something certainly, David, that we've heard is people like Elizabeth Warren and others saying, well, we don't know the whole story. It'd be nice to know the actual facts of what the deal would be, you know, first, right?
Absolutely. What's interesting about this is a deal that's been being negotiated for about 5 years now by different levels. More and more countries have gotten into it. And along the way, those who have been interested have sought to see a lot of the terms. But, you know, this is interesting because these big trade deals contain, you know, U.S. business interests and secrets and so on, and they're conducted under behind closed doors. A lot of it's classified. Lawmakers are able to see it, but with very limited staff. They don't always see the final text. It sort of works in progress. And so Elizabeth Warren and others are saying, not only do we not really understand what's in it, and even those of us who are interested, but the general public has no idea what's in this deal. And so, you know, we can't just take you at your word that we're going to have labor and environmental protections and other things that we're asking for. And President Obama calls this a new 21st century model that's different than NAFTA and old deals that Democrats largely have looked down upon. So she's saying, why do we have to rush this? This fast track is too rushed. The administration is saying, again, these Asian countries are not going to come and complete this deal until they see that Congress is behind this, basically, and this is a signal to do so. And then the administration also is concerned that this is going to get wrapped up, and already is, in presidential politics by next year. This is their last window to really get this done.
I want to bring in John Bartow, again, former vice president and general manager at Ansonio Copper and Brass. We brought you into this conversation because we wanted to get your perspective on what you think a trade deal like this would do. So first of all, your broad thoughts about this political battle right now over this issue when you hear the Obama administration essentially fighting with its own base, fighting with labor. As someone from the business world, what do you see?
Well, to me, it's very perplexing. I can't understand what I can't see. And the fact that my elected representatives can't look at it either brings a much, much larger issue into play. I think that our democracy is being challenged by the fast-track process. I think it inhibits the everyday citizen to understand what's going on, and all we're left with is political rhetoric. Basically, the president saying, trust me. We do know that the deal is being negotiated by the heads of multinational corporations, the executive branch, and you know, anytime something's done behind closed doors, I believe I'm not alone in feeling very nervous about what those implications may be. What are they trying to hide?
Well, so your first concern is, what are they trying to hide? It's a concern that, as we said, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts certainly has. Our own Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro has expressed her concerns as well. And she's, you know, a member of Democratic leadership. If she's up against the president here, it seems as though an awful lot of Democrats are. Why don't you give me, for lack of any better term, John, some of your worst case scenarios? I mean, maybe you don't know what's in this plan exactly, but what are the things that you fear?
My biggest fear is that this trade policy follows suit with NAFTA, CAFTA, the CORUS, FTA. All of those were promised to be great opportunities for increasing our trade and increasing jobs, and they've done the exact opposite in every single case. And NAFTA, the numbers are out at age 20, how many jobs have been lost, the trade imbalance has been increased by that. And most recently and alarmingly, I think, is the Korean U.S. free trade agreement, which has already cost the country 85,000 jobs in manufacturing in an enormous deficit that's snowballing. If you just were to look at a graph of what our trade balance has been since 1974, I believe, when Fast Track first came around, it has just snowballed and gone down and down and down. And the people who lose in this are the business owners, small business owners, which make up most of the gross national profit, and the workers. And those are my concerns. And I don't see anything differentiating itself, though we've not seen the full provisions. I just don't know how it's going to be different than anything that we've seen in the past. And currency manipulation is really at the heart of this issue. And there's no provision for that that I'm aware of for what we have learned to address that issue.
David, I'm not going to ask you to speak on behalf of the Obama administration, but I mean, what would you sense that the president would say if John Bartow or anybody else stood up at a town hall meeting and said what he just said to President Obama?
I think he would emphasize that he understands their concerns, that he himself voiced some of those concerns about NAFTA in his 2008 campaign. When he said that he would reopen and renegotiate that deal, that it had not lived up to his promises. But he would say that, and he has said that, in his mind, it's foolish for the U.S. to sort of turn away from some of these large kind of agreements that could help for a number of reasons, not just the economy, but geopolitics and national security. This is a fast-growing area. The U.S. wants to be involved. If not, and specifically on this deal, which has mostly to do with Asia, he's saying, look, China's going to get in there regardless of what we do. They're going to have their own pacts. They're going to have their own agreements. And countries like Vietnam and other countries with very low standards for labor and environment are not going to play by the same rules as the United States. And so the U.S., to have these kind of structures, they may not be perfect, I think the president would say, but, it's better than letting China write the rules. They continue to press that line. I think that it's falling on deaf ears largely among some of the traditional Democratic base. But the president is, fully invested in this. They've sunk a lot of presidential time and commitment across the administration into this, and they see a finish line now. And I think they're really going to go for it next week. Japan Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will talk before a joint session of Congress, a very rare occasion, and he's going to make the case as well. Japan's a partner in this as well. So the president's all in, we're basically looking at the next few months to determine if it's going to happen.
So John, we're hearing, the president say, we don't want to let China set the rules here. I mean, do you understand his point?
I do, and I do think it's important to project our influence over China. However, this trade pact is, I don't think, the approach that I would want to take. I would be much more interested in looking at the currency manipulation that has been going on for years and years and years, which has devalued the renminbi against the U.S. dollar by, I think, $100 gets you $600 RMB. And, that's the issue. That's what's at play. It's the same thing in Mexico. The currency arbitrage is what makes it possible for these large companies to send their workers, to export our jobs to the Mexico, Korea, and now we're talking about a much broader base of countries that basically destroys corporations, destroys manufacturing, and creates a tax burden for our population.
Maybe doesn't destroy all corporations, destroys smaller corporations,
like
yours. So give me the specific example of your company, Ansonia Copper and Brass. You closed in 2007.
Yeah. Well, 2007, we closed the larger portion of our business, and then we were there was a spinoff, if you will. Certain assets of our company were bought, our tubing assets, with a private equity group, and this is all another story. But that company that closed down was a very large company, and the one that resulted was Ansonia Specialty Metals. We were the last domestic supplier of copper nickel tubing to the United States Navy and all the amphibs. And so here we are because of NAFTA, because of course, FTA was what killed us. That and the continuing resolutions in Washington really put a clamp down on the spending for new construction. But the point I'm driving to here, or laboring to, is the fact that these trade agreements allowed a company in Mexico, owned by the richest man in the world, Carlos Slim, and a company in Korea. It just so happened that they had the ability to make these products. And by both of those being able to sell to our United States military, put us out of business because of the fact that we could not compete on price.
David, but before we run out of time, you know, our own Senator Chris Murphy has been pushing for years a kind of a made in the USA bill through Congress, trying to get the U.S. government to buy more U.S. built products. It seems as though there is this real divide between the Obama administration and maybe, I don't know, any administration that would get into the presidency, and an awful lot of the rank and file, whether it's businesses, people like John, whether it's people in labor unions. I mean, how does this all resolve in your mind? Because clearly this is more than just a political debate right now. This is really, you know, getting at some of what Elizabeth Warren has talked about big corporations and the little guy and who's on whose side.
Well, that, absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting here is Obama's allies, traditional allies and base, are saying, hey, the president's talked so much over his time in office about narrowing the income gap, about growing inequality. That's his biggest domestic issue that he's, or agenda item that he's pushing now. You know, the minute the president talks about the improvements in the economy and the stock market, even in the job numbers, you know, he says they're not done yet, but they've been coming up. And so, you know, so he talks a lot about, but he also talks a lot about, again, that income gap, and that not everybody is partaking in some of the upturn in the economy where you do see that. So then at the same time, he's talking about this sort of international trade deal that, you know, a lot of the base does not like, and they're saying is going to go against his very big domestic priority. And so this is an ongoing dispute. You know, Hillary Clinton's in a tough spot because she touted the deal as Secretary of State for President Obama, but now she's hesitant to sort of really endorse it all. Because Elizabeth Warren or others are against it. You have Sherrod Brown, others in Ohio, really in manufacturing states, who are really, really against this idea. And I think, as you mentioned, it's going to go on. It's really dividing. There's concerns it could divide Democrats a bit leading into the election, which would be a problem. And certainly the president, you know, has not often allied himself with Republicans. And here he sees a chance to sort of do a big legislative achievement in his final 2 years, a big, you know, turn for his Asia policy. But he's having the biggest trouble making the economic argument about how this is going to work. And so unless he really, you know, figures out that, it's going to be hard to convince Democrats. They may not need that many Democrats, but they're going to need some.
David Nakamura covers the White House for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for your time, David. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
John Barto, before we run out of time, just could you bring this home for us in Connecticut right here? We talked a little bit about your business. I mean, if this goes through, what do you see as some of the possibilities for people who work, try to make things, try to make a living here in the state?
Well, I see the ripple effect of job loss continuing is what I see. It's not a very pretty picture. It is creating a very unfair playing ground, and we are allowing these multinational corporations to decide policy for themselves. You know, essentially, that's one of the things that I do know about the TPP is that they're basically negotiating an agreement on behalf of themselves, and that's a no-win situation for the middle class.
If a trade deal is going to go through, what's something that you think it might need to actually preserve some of the protections that you'd like?
Well, I would like to see a provision on currency manipulation that has teeth and can be enforced, just like NAFTA had all of these provisions that have not been upheld. That's really my chief concern. It's legislation without with teeth. So the businesses at the top levels win. You know, we were a small business, but I mean, we had revenues of $70 million at one point in time, during my time, we had 375 employees. That's a pretty good sized company, and now it's gone. And I see that unfortunate scenario playing itself out over and over again. And this president said, I believe, in his campaign in 2008, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that he was against any kind of NAFTA or CAFTA type deal. So I'm very interested to find out how this would be different and how he plans to honor his word or his campaign promise.
And a last thing for you, we just have a little bit less than a minute left. The first thing you said, though, your biggest concern is just not knowing what's in there. This lack of transparency is something that's come up and been it's a criticism that's been levied at the Obama administration over and over again. It seems like that is a chief concern of you and many others.
Absolutely. You know, we've heard nothing but how transparent this administration was going to be, yet we've seen numerous occasions where that has not been the case. And I certainly understand that you have to have a certain degree of secrecy, privacy, confidentiality, but certainly something like this that affects so many in a commercial way as well as in a personal way, we need to be able to have access, or have our elected officials have access, and not have just an up or down vote with no ability to go back and change any of the provisions. So that's really the frustrating aspect for me.
John Bartos, the former vice president and general manager at Ansonia Copper and Brass. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, John. Thank you so much.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kion Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to our interns, Julia Pastel and Kelsey Bissell. You can continue this conversation on our website. It's wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.